Yeah, what raises something that's particularly bothered me about the theory, which is from an anarchist perspective, there's no concept of decentralization. There's no, that is, while there is local democracy, it's still all geared towards the continental-wide or whatever system. There doesn't seem to be any notion of an effort to try to make things, organize the technology and the planning to increase local community, face-to-face democracy, self-governing at a local level, which would be important because I would imagine any kind of planning would go much better to the extent that it is local and easier for people to understand, at least at a regional level. And I find that a kind of a weakness, which is the opposite of the weakness
you pointed
to.
They're like, we like big, extensive division of labor over a large territory. We think autonomy is a bad value. They're like, we think that everybody's already interdependent, and we just want to reflect that fact in the economy. And they don't really put any value on sort of local autonomy.
Well, it would seem to contradict the notion of trying to decrease the amount of centralization and of the authority and central planning and so forth.
Well, except this process doesn't really have an authority. You could write a computer program to do this. Right, so it's not that...
The more complex that program is, that is, the more centralized and widespread it is, the more complex it's going to be, and therefore the wider the likelihood of disturbances is going to be. Which doesn't mean that they can't be... I mean, this doesn't mean that it's either total autonomy or the world state. It's, you know, there's whole levels of federation and planning and so forth that could be built in.
I agree, that's a nice... That would be a nice thing to have in this, but they're explicit about
it.
Was there a hand over?
Yeah, I was going to ask a question. What's their view on private property and who owns land? And is there anything like that in there?
They sort of think that everything's public property, and then it's sort of allocated through this process of you make, that all the serious stuff is public property. Things like toothbrushes and your morning muffin are private property, and but the means of production are public property and stuff like that. I have an open question, which is, how do you enforce property rights? How do you prevent theft? Presumably, we'd like to prevent theft after the revolution because it'll all be equal, so you shouldn't need to steal, or if we believe that this is just, then we'd want to protect the property rights that people have in this. And they say that, well, that's a political question. That's different. And I'm like, what are you talking about? That is the question is who enforces property rights and how do they do it? And I have no idea. Suggestions are welcome. how do we do law essentially after?
That's for any post-revolution system is the question. It's a huge one. Uh-huh. And I'm not going to answer it. Well, maybe, unless other people wanted to answer it, because
the community councils. The community councils and the armed population.
And what?
Just like the U.S.?
The U.S. is not run by community councils, and the population is hardly armed.
Let's say that the idea that I have is minority ideas or minority concerns. There's one person in this council and it's a loner who wants to write on how butterfly reproduce, and people think it's irrelevant, and years after years they don't want to give that person a chance to do that. It's just a stupid example, but it can happen
really
for culture, it can happen for really various reasons, also needs that are not recognized by the council.
So they've built in two things to deal with that, although I think it's a really good, a totally awesome question, that they're sort of saying that, So the way this happens under capitalism, if one capitalist refuses your great idea, you can always go to another one, and this is supposedly how the market, you know, makes great projects. But there's no, but for
until the scholar just decides to give it up.
Yeah. But the way they say here is that you can always make a proposal to another consumption council that's not your own. If you run up against a wall with your own consumption council, you can make anonymous requests. If you want to order kinky underwear or something and don't want your your council, you can make anonymous requests to another consumption council, as long as it falls under your as long as it's sort of under your budget from what you're getting from your work council.
Okay. But I'm pushing that forward, even though it's interesting. But like, okay, what about like I don't know? There's a like something that like some I don't know how to express it in English. Sorry, it's kind of hard. But like, how if someone like is in a specific situation that is shared by other people and other councils, but not that many people in the society, like, how do they organize? Like, it's like, I think that the council structure makes it really individualistic, and then it's kind of, it makes it hard for people to organize on, like, a interest level base or whatever, need base or, you know, another point of view base or whatever, you know?
That's true, although it's also, so I think the way that Michael Albert and Robin Hanawa defended it is they're like, yeah, but it's better than the way it would happen under capitalism. Well, which is, you know, kind of pathetic. But it's also that a big problem with this is that it takes the council structure that it's given, which is something you were mentioning earlier today, that it sort of takes this council thing as, all right, you know, somebody comes down and says, here's what the council structures ought to be. That's it for life. And now then, when you move, and, you know, even when they're writing about this, they sort of say that you have, like, this neighborhood, then township, then county, then state, and they're sort of maintaining that idea that ideal forms of communities should be, like, geographic and fixed, as opposed to, you know, anyway. I'm not a big fan.
Yeah, it seems like, many kind of centralized economic plans, this would just produce a lot of unregulated economic activity. And is that understood, or is there some sort of active denial that that's really going to happen, or is that somehow built into the system? And in a way that might address part of your question is because I had my father's from the kibbutz system in Israel, and he was an artist. And, you know, that's not something that's necessarily rewarded by the community as, like, a productive activity. And all the artists on the kibbutzim were faced with this choice. You can either produce for the community and then have it included in what they then try and sell on the market, and then you get a percentage of that back, or you do it on your own free time and get no support for it and come up with the resources completely on your own.
What do you think about that?
Well, some artists made the choice to have it included in the kibbutz economy. Some chose to do it on their free time, or my father decided to leave the kibbutz.
Well, about the black market stuff, I think it's, you know, is Craigslist going to be allowed under participatory economics? For those of you that don't know, Craigslist is like this online marketplace that you can offer stuff for trade, and it's like when I mentioned this to Michael Albert, I was like, surely there's a limited role for markets here, because the kinds of state repression you would need to bar consensual exchanges is enormous. If, like, you know, I have I have a block of cheese and my neighbor has carrots that I need and I want to trade them, that's the beginnings of a market. And, you know, if we can agree that post-it notes that say cheese on them is going to be the currency of choice, then, you know, we're sort of going to see the beginnings of a pretty big market. And Michael Albert told me that markets are a weed that should be exterminated. And I was like, okay, that doesn't strike me as realistic, because you need an enormous police apparatus to enforce that you're going to actually get rid of all sorts of consensual exchanges. But then how do you limit the scope of the markets to only the stuff that you want? We don't really feel that trading chairs, stuff like that, is really problematic. What gets us going is, like, labor and capital and land and housing and environmental stuff. But I don't know, how do you keep one from growing into the other? So I don't have an answer to that.
I don't know if this is an answer, but it's just an interesting case example I lived in India as a student, and one of the an interesting anomaly, I guess, in the world today is the state of Kerala. And the interesting thing about this one state, which successively elected communist governments, which implemented the most extensive form of land reform perhaps in the world, in that one state, is that as you travel around the country, the entire country, you'll see these massive slums in every city that you enter. They're just daunting. And then you enter Kerala, and they're gone. And it's not because of state repression. It actually is because there's no, the economy just doesn't produce slums. And so it is very interesting that there's some merit to Albert's argument that it is a weed that is produced, but the response to that weed once it's produced due to a failure in the planning, is he suggesting actual repression, or?
I think he, you know, he says, I don't do politics, and that's politics. But I should take back what I said, which is, you know, we already have pretty strong social norms against some kinds of markets, right? We don't, you know, people are dicey when it comes to markets around internal organs and blood and political office, and, you know, we feel that nobody should be allowed to sell themselves into slavery. So there are already sort of social norms that are in place against sort of markets going into these areas.
Nobody sells political office anymore.
Nobody's advertising, at least.
They've all been bought up. There's no more left.
Yeah, right. They're all private property now. They're not traded. It's like right, so we already have sort of some implicit ideas that some things just aren't for sale. And maybe some of the stuff that prevents this limiting of markets is sort of expanding that sphere of just some things are not for sale to this wider category of goods. I have no idea.
Does this have to be the world system? Let me ask, because what I'm thinking of is, sounds like something like that is what I, as a socialist anarchist, anarcho-communist, would want to see. But not necessarily this particular system or particular way it's worked out here. And obviously there are all sorts of questions here. And I imagine a society in which different regions or different parts of the world or different parts of the North America, whatever, try out different kind of stuff. In which one area might try this pure following the textbook of Parakan by Michael Albert, and somebody else might try something with a little more centralized planning, and somebody else might try something with a little wider range of a decentralized market socialism, if you can call it that, with co-ops and so forth, but no one's allowed to exploit anybody. And people might try different combinations in different places. Now maybe they'll screw up the whole iterative planning mechanism, but it seems to me that some kind of experimental approach because would make more sense than say we have the one system that we know that's going to solve everything and we can sit here and decide that ahead of time.
Well, so one thing I wanted to talk about, which is related to that, is sort of this, like, what does economic vision look like? Does it look like drawing up these blueprints for, all right, here's how this is going to work, here's how this is going to work, here's how they're going to fit together, and then sort of flexing your argument muscles and showing that yes, no, this will actually work out the way that you said. Well, I'm not entirely sure. It's not the way I approach sort of economic vision stuff. I think much more in terms of small, not small, but like particular mechanisms that you can implement right now and that sort of have complementarities that can sort of that you can sort of see something emerge as a bunch of things fitting together that you can implement any one of those things in part on its own. It's so, and you know, I'm a big fan of using the raw material we have at hand, like co-ops and open source and also, you know, community management stuff, and taking those things and sort of seeing, okay, what of this can we expand and what do we have to contract to get something that looks closer to what we'd like to see. But I don't know, what do people think like about this, the sort of aesthetic or style of thinking about what the post-revolution economy will look like, and I don't know, how are we doing for time as well?
Oh, 35 minutes.
Great. So yeah.
Knock yourself out.
No, I don't. I'm honestly curious. Like, what do people think about economic vision stuff generally?
I mean, I think that there's certain portions of the Parakan vision that I've found, like, I like the fact that they've flushed it out. I mean, like, if not all the way, but a lot deeper than a lot of other people. But I don't really understand exactly what they see as like a way to transition towards this.
They've written on it. They sort of say that it's that one of the first steps is, you know, getting workers' councils in places like that. It's, you know, they sort of see it as something like, oh, unions fighting for workplace control, and then sort of starting something like consumer councils in some places, and then sort of figuring out at some level that you can do this sort of iterative planning between those things, and then once you can do that at a small scale, you can grow it to a larger scale. So, you know, that's probably as specific as you can get with this kind of stuff. You know, it's obviously not going to happen that way, but that's sort of their response to that transition sort of thing. I am just channeling.
I think when it comes to the merits of more specific economic blueprints like this, I think it's traditionally been a pretty easy thing to say, like, oh, you know, as anarchists, we can't impose a blueprint on the future, and which I think has often been a cop-out behind, you know, a way to avoid trying to tackle very complex, contradictory issues. So I think something like Paracon, blueprints are useful as something to, first of all, as something to point to say, like, look, here is a possibility, you know, when you're talking to people out who aren't the unconverted, you know, who you can, you know, say, look, we're not total lunatics, you know, this is something that might be plausible. I think it's also important as something, you know, that you could draw on if you wanted to, that you could draw on parts of if you wanted to, which is better than not having anything to draw on, you know, when and if an opportunity to do so arose. So I think this sort of thing, it's good and important to have. It's also important not to treat it as an exclusive and only, you know, like, the way.
I'm still in the question mode, though. No, but, like, a question to answer yours. I've been thinking in the last, like, 5 minutes with, like, everybody's intervention and stuff, like, okay, do we, like, money as, like, I don't know those specific concepts in French, in English, I mean, but anyways, money is, like, a tool we use to exchange goods and services and stuff, right, basic. So, do we absolutely need to get rid of it? Like, if money doesn't have the same role and is not perceived the same way and is not used the same way and you can't stack it and is distributed differently and, you know... I think it's a really great way of exchanging
all-time great
things.
Innovations of humans with,
like,
the money thing.
You know, like, it's just how do you change the value of money, like the social value?
One proposal put forward by Silvio Gazzell, this monetary crank at the turn of the century, was that you have negative interest rates on money so that you can't accumulate.
The more you have, the less it's worth.
Yeah.
Cool.
That's you gotta
cool.
spend this shit. And it's an interesting, I haven't really thought through it, and a lot of people poo-pooed on it, but so that's out there. And I sort of agree. It's the problem is what do you do when someone says, well, I've got all this money, wanna do me a favor and I'll give you a wage for it? And then that sort of rapidly turns into exploitation. That's
depending on how people get money.
Okay. But the problem is that this is the beauty of markets, is that it doesn't require anything for somebody to just point to someone else and say, I've got money, you want to work for me, and I can give it to you. And there's nothing in the world that can prevent that,
yeah.
And that's sort of...
No mediation.
And that's the labor market right there.
I think, like, an argument that Albert and Hal would have against that is, like, why would someone take this job where they're getting exploited when they could have a job where they're getting...
Because you can get exploited at really high pay. And you could get paid, like... So consider, it's like you could have an egalitarian society in Kerala versus being exploited in the U.S., but you can buy way more in the U.S. And that sort of the absolute level of wealth versus your rate of exploitation can be, like, you can get paid a higher wage as well as being more exploited.
Also, I guess if he doesn't do politics, he probably doesn't do psychology or sociology, which
yeah,
would account
that's a big
for...
Problem. That's the thing. He's sort of, you know, Albert and Hanel were sort of schooled in this 1970s style of economics where it's like everybody is perfectly rational, everybody knows everything, and so they go through their models, and then they use arguments like, if people were doing such and such, like, that is irrational, And I'm like, that, man, people do irrational shit all the time. And people are bad planners. So this idea of for forecasting, you can just picture people. Like, I'm like, I want cheesy poofs for the month of January and nothing for the rest of the year. And that's actually like a phenomenon that we document in experimental stuff. When we make people make plans over the horizon, people front load their consumption so much. Like, they want stuff now, and then they kind of don't really worry about the long run. You know, I don't.
I guess when I finished reading this book, my almost response was sort of a bit of cherry picking from it, and like I thought, you know, the balanced job complex, I love that idea, you know, or looking at sort of what we always talked about, you know, sort of municipalizing or socializing capital, right, and then sort of putting those two together, and sort of with and I guess you and I read it differently, where I sort of saw
can
that.
Can you
like,
talk a little slower?
Oh, sorry.
I'm really sorry. It's just that I want to understand what you're saying.
And I guess like you and I read I sort of read the idea of effort as basically being by hour, like sort of if we all assumed balanced job complexes, then we all have a certain and so what and I thought it was kind of an interesting idea where you equalize everyone. Essentially, you've eliminated the problem of the capitalist and the exploited class by basically saying that everyone has more or less the same spending power within the economy. And I thought these were kind of interesting ideas, but then I sort of got there and it's, well, once we've got that, then we've pretty much got the preconditions of what capitalist, you know, classical economics says, that if you have perfect information and perfect equality, then markets will operate perfectly anyway. And so it's just kind of like, it's just like their whole planning system was almost like if you make all these assumptions that we're just basically at textbook capitalism, you know.
Partly. Although I didn't really, again, I'm sort of like still on that time thing that I didn't read that, because they're very much into the idea that if you work very hard, it doesn't matter how much sugar cane you cut, but if you're a small person and are working your heart out, you should get paid more than the big person that can you know, cut way more sugar cane than you, but doesn't have to work as hard. So they're gung-ho on that. So the stuff about textbook economics is, yeah, and then in the 80s and 90s in economics, it really changed, like, people, we started exploring all these ideas of people being not rational and that markets broke all the time, and, you know, I actually thought it became a much better discipline. But these guys learned it before that. So.
Did they talk anywhere about people's subjectivity and that what's difficult and arduous for one person might be relatively easy for another person? Because I'm not sure, like, I guess I'm still not sure about how the whole valuing of people's labor happens. Like, if you've got somebody in a job that's really hard for them to do in a way that they really don't want to do it and maybe just aren't really that good at it, but you pay them more for doing it because
so
of that, like,
they sort of think that would be handled by the fact that nobody knows how much you're working better than your teammates, than the people you work with. That's what they say about that. And so they're like, you know, it's not that hard, that your workmates will be able to accurately assess how hard you're working. And, you know, they make an analogy drawn from school that in grade school and high school that your teachers will often grade you according to effort. And then they sort of say, because teachers can do it in the high school setting, it must be easy in general. I don't...
I don't really hear that directed at what you were saying, because I know personally situations where I have a particular talent for a particular kind of mental work, and I get things done much faster than other people who are quite capable of doing it. You know, and I spend the rest of my time, you know, like reading intellectual history and politics and writing but I'm actually being paid for my day job, which other people would have to work longer hours to do. And, you know, they're obviously working harder than I am, but what I was hearing in your question is, you know, how do you rate that? They're working harder, but producing as much in more time.
I guess what I thought, what I had been thinking before I said this now is that I actually hadn't thought of it as the actual person gets rated, but I thought when I read it a long time ago that it was more like the actual job gets rated and people say, how hard is this job? And to me, I guess that was the problem with saying, well, it's, you know, harder for one person than another. I wasn't even thinking in terms of their talents, but I was thinking in terms of what they enjoy. You know, some people might find something, you know, really irritating, and like, and other people might find it fine. But you're saying that that it's not based on the job, it's based on the person in the job.
Yeah, that's my impression.
They also suppose a certain amount of geographical fixity. Do they suppose a certain amount of occupational fixity?
They say that you can change your job whenever you'd like by just sort of making an application to a different work council, and in the same way you'd do it in a labor market, like if they need you.
You apply for a grant if you want retraining, if you don't like what you've been doing, kind of thing.
Marx deals with that in terms of the jobs and the inequality by saying in a lower stage of communism, you paid for the number of hours you work, and it is unequal, and that's just the way it is until you get to a society where, because there has to be a certain amount of inequality, there's no perfection is not of this world, and that's as close to equality as you're going to get as long as there's a limited amount of goods and so forth that you can provide. And then he imagines a certain kind of society based on more equality when it's just a lot more productivity. I can imagine a situation, something like what you're describing, but as you get more, there's a certain amount of things that are totally free right now, even now under capitalism, like, you know, mostly usually water or riding on the streets, not free, but paid through taxes or some way or other. But you don't pay individually. And I can imagine as society gets more productive, that kind of free communist sector expanding, so that there are the more things that we could provide, you know, because we can produce so much more, the fewer things have to be determined by how many hours you work.
I'm not willing to really predicate too much political vision on the post-scarcity sort of stuff, that it's like we're always going to want more stuff, or I'm not willing to make the assumption that at some point we're going to exhaust our wants. And so I still operate in this framework of there's only so much stuff and we need to allocate it to so many people. But I understand that. But once we've solved that problem of when we just can produce so much, then there's no economic problem anymore.
Well, what you've already been describing requires, certainly with all those damn meetings, better be a lot of leisure time.
Because
if you don't have a lot of leisure time, if you can't provide at least a certain level of decency, you know, in a certain amount of time, if people have to work for 10 hours a day or whatever to provide plenty for all, then, you know, forget about it. We just have to have the experts do it for us.
They sort of say that actually the number of meetings is no higher than that which is done under capitalism, which is probably true. There's a lot of people who spend a lot of time in meetings under capitalism, and it's just the same people are always in the same meetings. And this is the idea, it's like sort of spreading that work around.
I just wanted to revisit the whole post-scarcity topic briefly, not so much as exhaustion of wants, but I mean, one thing I'm sort of struck by is, so we talk about reducing the amount of men's work. You know, I'd be quite happy to get rid of, like, all the speculators and the arbitragers and the people building nuclear weapons. Like, it's sort of, we already have all the surplus. Like, to some extent, capitalism is all about how can we vastly expand markets because of this, you know, growth for the growth's sake, and this sort of, you know, what do we do with all this productive capacity? How do we get people working more? You know, it's, so I'm also not, like, part of me is kind of like, maybe it's not quite post-scarcity in the sense of, like, post-want, but sort of like, it's, or, you know, sort of, I guess where I'm just going with it, sort of like we already, you know, I guess something also bothered me about this, like, you know, is how can we find a better way of running the modern industrial economy? And it's like, well, why would we want to run the whole damn thing in the first place? You know?
Going back to like rating someone's work and how much consumption shares they have, like, I'm wondering what your thought on this is, because I can't seem to get like a real good answer reading Paracon stuff. Like, say you have someone that they're doing this job and their rating is like really high, so they get this like.
They have bank.
Yeah, and they don't need that much to live on, so they have these extra consumption shares that either they could hold on to, or say they buy up a lot of like non-perishable goods. Like, what prevents the accumulation of that, or like even getting passed down through generations? Like, I don't know, you gave the example of like enforcing the consumption shares to be used immediately, but
okay,
like they could just get something that could,
spam and hoard it in their basement for. but
there's
I don't know. I don't They don't have a good answer to that. I don't have a good answer to that. Another question I'm sort of wanting to throw out there is sort of how do we feel about that entire idea of allocation according to effort? Like, it's like that's sort of a school of political philosophy that sort of sees that the way justice is it's a map from people to money, and we need to find the right. It's like you have this function that'll run on people and give them a certain amount of money depending on, you know, how much they work, various traits on those people, and it gives you money. Well, you know, there's other ideas of what justice should look like, which is one, for example, that different things ought to have different standards of justice applied to them. Like, jobs should be allocated this way, organs should be allocated this way, you know, political office should be organized this way, and that it's very, very, like, good specific rather than people specific. So it doesn't say that okay, you're a hard worker, you should get lots of stuff. It says, well, this is the stuff of, you know, housing. Now, what's a good distribution of housing independent of the people that are in that? And that's just sort of another way of looking at what's the right principle of distributive justice that should animate society. I'm just not sure about this particular way being this map from people to stuff as opposed to just sort of a distribution of stuff that's independent of the people that make it up. Because at one level, the only thing we really know is that we certainly can implement a distribution of goods. I don't know that we can implement, if we can actually look at every person and be like, that person's working harder than that person, they should get more stuff. It strikes me as really micromanaging and stuff.
I just totally off the top of my head listening to this, is there another way of trying to organize something perhaps somewhat vaguely similar to this for capital inputs, but firms running really without any profit motive, so that you disconnect allocation of capital resources from considerations of profit? The firm sells its goods on a market and divides the proceeds entirely among the members of the firm, assuming that you've got it balanced, and then applies to whatever authority for more capital inputs for the next cycle.
I said capital inputs here wouldn't be, in this thing, isn't money.
Right.
So it would be actual machines,
mm-hmm.
and stuff that you, that why would you distribute it equally? Like, what's the gain from distributing it to all the people that are part of that and letting it take?
I just try to think of, you know, since the whole function or the way the capital markets operate is constantly to drive businesses to increase the rate of exploitation because they need to reinvest profit, they need to show high profits in order to get investment from others. If there's some way of operating a market at one level without the additional spur of constantly increasing profits and competing to...
Well, we have nonprofits. Well, nonprofit co-ops look a lot like
you
said.
Yeah, and you know, should we be looking at ways of coordinating their needs rather than coordinating needs at the individual level?
I guess I'm not really answering. I'm asking a related question, I guess, which is, how do these guys see the job of a firm? Are firms still making profits? Like, if prices and quantities are set by this iterative board, then each individual firm, could it be operating at a profit or a loss if the prices are set? I don't really get that. I mean, so if there is a profit back to a firm, I don't see why there wouldn't be. I mean, we're not saying that all firms are operating, what do you call that, at the level, break-even point.
Yeah.
So if they are making a surplus or a deficit, what happens to that? If they're making profits, where do they put it? Normally what a business would do is they would invest it back in the business, but if we're saying that the means of production are collectively owned, then what does it mean that this, then is any profit of any business then collectively owned?
That's what they say, that profits are collectively owned. Firms can make profits, and they can sort of retain them as earnings, but they can't pay it out to the people that work there. They can't give them any of your bonus.
Can they invest it in better machinery for themselves?
I don't know the answer to that. Yeah,
but if it's collectively, but you're saying it's collectively owned by the people who work in that place, not collectively owned by the community at large.
I don't know.
Okay.
Presumably, when the firm goes next time around to ask what they need to buy to have new machinery, they do not have to list what they've already got.
Yeah,
that extra profit.
The process of asking for new machinery, I think, is different than. I mean, investing in assets, I think, is different than asking for a bundle of inputs. You know, it's
right.
It's a profit and loss question rather than
a
balance sheet question. So you're asking for inputs to your business, but investing in new assets, like investing in a new machine that's going to turn those inputs into products faster, is a different question that I think that you said that we. You know, we collectively own the means of production, meaning
society as a whole.
Yeah. So who makes the decision then about getting the new machine or not?
That's a great question, and I don't know. I think they keep it at. My guess would be that they keep it at return to earnings, and they do something like what Wayne said.
I mean, based on my kind of vague, I think that they're not really making a good differentiation between. What's an input to your business and what's a capital improvement in your business.
Right, but most economists wouldn't. Like, those two things are sort of seen as the same.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you can return to earnings can either be, like, improving your current technology or it can be, like, improved inventory of increasing your supplies. Is that the distinction you're drawing?
Yeah, but it's... Hmm. I mean, it's for the practical day-to-day running of a business, that's a really big distinction.
Uh-huh. I believe that.
Good question. So the way I see it is that in the course of a revolution, let's say, where, as has generally been the case in least industrialized countries, people throw up councils of form to work as fat factories and workplaces and so on, and in communities. And besides... say, fighting off the police or the army or whatnot, or chasing away the state, taking over the power, people decide, well, let's go back into the factories and let's decide now we're going to run it. And then they have to make decisions how they're going to run it and how they're going to change the economy and change things and communicate with each other and with the community organizations and with whatever consumer co-ops or producer co-ops that have survived or developed under the old circumstances. And I would imagine it would start out with something somewhat more or less like you've been describing here.
Possibly.
And they would run into...
It would start out with like the group that was organizing the revolution. I'm thinking of this Vienna example that I brought up in Stacy's workshop. But in Red Vienna in the 1920s, there was this huge... Okay, so 25% of the population of Vienna was in this one trade union. And the city had two keys to the town armory. One was held by the mayor, the other was held by the head of the trade union. And the trade union ran all these co-ops and all this stuff. And then the fascists tried to mount a putsch, and the union just went out on strike. So 500,000 people. So they had all these co-ops and stuff that they were running on their own, and then the way that they allocated stuff was that the trade union sort of council would make requisitions to the co-ops, and the co-ops would fill the orders as requisitioned by the co-op council. So that might look something like this, but they didn't use prices, for example. They just said, we need 250 donuts or something like that. By the way, the reason they lost is because the trade union leader, Otto Bauer, gave his key up to the fascist leader. Here you go.
I mean, yeah, this essentially the same system operating in Barcelona immediately, you know, at the very beginning of the Spanish Civil War.
Right.
Like, within the first week, they had the same thing. You had requests coming in from the country and lists of what they could produce, and you had, like, you know, we want so many shoes out here at this farming collective, and, you know, and back in the city, we need, you know, 400 eggs.
Uh-huh.
Did it work out?
I don't know anything about this.
From my readings, yes, the economy of Barcelona was back on its feet to, you know, close or as very close to the possible extent it could be under the circumstances within like the first week.
Oh, there's a lot of literature on this.
Yeah.
Robert Alexander's two-volume book, Anarchist in the Spanish Civil War, I think is where that particular example comes out of. Or that
Sam Dolgoff's book on the collectives in Spanish Civil War.
Or that might even be, there's a oral history called Blood of Spain, which has a different title in Britain.
There's vast literature on it.
Yeah, well, I don't know the specific example.
That's good. I should get that from you.
Cindy's telling me 5 minutes.
Cindy said 5 minutes? Oh. Hi, Cindy.
At some point, it's going to shake out.
Yeah.
It's going to start like something like this. Right. Something's going to shake out one way or another, you know.
It's interesting. I've sort of thought that one of the cool things about this is sort of its account of sort of consumption is democratic, which is something that we don't really do a lot, maybe in our housing situations a bit, that, you know, we sort of come up with our, at least in, you know, my housing situation, like with 10 people, so, you know, we get together and make our shopping lists, and sort of people pay in proportion to what they can afford. So we've tried to do that, but sort of on a larger scale, trying to make consumption kind of accountable. So it's like, just because you're a lawyer and make $50,000 a year doesn't mean you get to spend all of that you have to redistribute it to the rest of the household, and that bringing it in at the point of, you know, what are you allowed to spend your money on? And if you really believe in these values, how, you know, you need to make, like, you need to be seriously egalitarian about your wage. So can I recommend three books? One is, If You're an Egalitarian, How Come You're So Rich? And it's by G.A. Cohen, who's a Montreal-born Marxist philosopher. And it's a really well-written, it's a bunch of lectures he gave, and it's a, sort of attacking this question of, okay, you claim to be Mr. High and Mighty Marxist academic, how much of your salary do you give away if you really believe in equality? And G.A. Cohen. What was the second book? Oh, Deepening Democracy by Eric Olin Wright. And it's sort of, I think it's actually a useful supplement to this Paracon model, because it goes through the actual mechanisms of how democratic decisions get made in the ground in, like, actual case studies. The best case study in this book is on Chicago, that apparently in Chicago they had this thing where police and school boards were made accountable to community meetings. So every 2 weeks, the police would have to show up, the police on a beat would have to show up to a community meeting, and they would have to get their priorities on what that community wanted for what their policing priorities should be. And it worked great. The reason it stopped was because the middle classes were like, eh. But the low-income people loved it. Same thing with the school boards in Chicago. Chicago is actually a wonderful city for social experiments like this. They've done a bunch of interesting stuff. And they've also, that book is just goes through all these case studies of where participatory democracy how it actually works on the ground, and how actually sometimes you need the state to make it work. That occasionally these Chicago meetings would break down, and so the police chief would send in like an arbitrator to sort of help get past this deadlock in the town meeting, in the community meeting. And Eric Olin Wright thinks that's part of what participatory democracy needs, is outside mediation when things break down. And
what's the author again,
sir? Eric Olin Wright and Archon Fung.
Thanks.
And there's, in fact, an entire series of books called Real Utopias that's sort of published by Verso. This is one of them, but there's four of them that's sort of going through like sort of having kind of dorky academics going through what sort of utopias can we build, like informed by what we see around us and what we know and stuff. And so my advisors wrote one of them, so I have to give a plug. The third set of books is on the post-scarcity stuff. It's the culture novels by Ian M. Banks, which is it's a wonderful science fiction stuff on all the things that can go horribly, horribly wrong even after you've solved the problem of scarcity. And it's, he's, you know, one of my all-time favorite science fiction writers. That's all.
This has been a recording of Suresh Naidu on Deconstructing Paracon, a critique of Albert and Hanel's vision of participatory economics. He spoke at the 2004 Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference at Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont, on September 25, 2004. Thanks for listening.